Welcome to the debate. What if the reason we struggle so profoundly to cure chronic disease is because we just keep treating the human body like a broken car engine?
Right. And, you know, there is a reason we do that. I mean, the car engine model is highly structured.
Sure, it is. When you look at a medical textbook, you expect this pristine map.
Exactly. You want to trace a causal path from a specific molecule to a cellular reaction with, like, perfect geometric certainty. That map is literally what allows us to synthesize life-saving drugs.
It is, yeah. But then you step out of the textbook and into the actual clinic, and the lived experience of health isn't a pristine grid at all.
No, it's definitely messy.
Extremely messy. You have a patient whose chronic stress is constantly altering their immune system. Or, you know, their neighborhood dictates their physical movement. Even their perception of a doctor's words can literally spike their blood pressure in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, that mechanistic map feels, frankly, entirely inadequate to describe the reality of navigating human health. For a long time, traditional biomedicine has isolated the pathways and the genes, but when we try to understand the actual whole human being, the map just fails to capture the territory.
And that tension right there is the exact focus of our discussion today.
Exactly. Today, we are examining Dr. Bechara Saley's 2026 academic white paper, The Biology of Living Coordination.
Which is a heavy one.
Paradigm shift. It lays out a five-domain framework intended to understand life without reducing it merely to genetics or, you know, isolated physiology or just subjective psychology alone.
Right. And the central question we really have to grapple with here is one of boundaries. I mean, does integrating concepts like emotional sentience or observer languaging and civilizational niches into the hard science of biology successfully create a more rigorous, life-coherent medicine?
And this is your perspective, I believe. Does it risk collapsing the operational precision of biology into vague holism and, frankly, sociological overreach?
I will be arguing that this integration is a vital, causally grounded evolution from molecular reductionism. I think it faithfully captures how living systems actually operate.
Right. And my position is that while multi-level causation is a highly valid concept in modern science, expanding the definition of biological mechanisms to include emotion and observer epistemology dangerously dilutes the boundaries we desperately need for actionable medical science.
Okay, so let's start with the foundation. From my perspective, traditional physiology is absolutely necessary, but on its own, it is deeply, deeply insufficient.
Well, I mean, insufficient for what exactly?
Insufficient for actually explaining living coordination. Dr. Saheli grounds this entire framework in Dennis Noble's concept of biological relativity.
Right, a classic.
Yeah. Now, for those who might not be deep in systems biology, this is the principle that no single biological level has causal sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
We used to think DNA was the master dictator, right? The blueprint that just fired one-way orders to the rest of the body. But biological relativity shows us that living function is realized through reciprocal boundary conditions across all levels.
Yeah, the cell environment dictates how the DNA is read, just as much as the DNA dictates what the cell builds.
Exactly.
And look, I am entirely on board with the scientific validity of Noble's biological relativity. The critique of molecular sovereignty is very well established at this point.
Right. The form of a system absolutely supplies boundary conditions for its components. I mean, if we were just debating systems biology, we wouldn't have much of a disagreement today.
Right? But here is where Saheli brilliantly advances the conversation, in my opinion. He takes Noble's causal architecture and combines it with Humberta Materna's concept of organism niche unity.
Okay, yes.
And also Catherine Pyle-Kaufman's emotional sentience. So the paper redefines disease not just as a mechanical breakdown of parts, but as a discoordination in living.
Which is a very broad term.
It is, but it's precise in context. It frames emotion not as some private psychological byproduct that happens to just float above the body, but as a core biological self-regulating sense.
But see, that's where I think we run into trouble.
Hear me out, though. This framework accurately captures the balanced, relational nature of life that reductionist biomedicine consistently misses. A human does not just process data. We feel, we evaluate, and we construct language that literally alters our physiological state. Saheli is trying to give us a disciplined scientific grammar to study this whole living coordination.
I mean, it is philosophically elegant. I will definitely give you that. But it vastly overextends the bounds of empirical biology.
How so?
I strongly push back on placing things like affective valuation and observer distinction making on the exact same foundational level as a physiological realization, like, you know, a kidney filtering toxins.
But they are constantly interacting.
They are, but the text explicitly warns against vague holism and anti-biomedical misuse, right? Yet when we start defining human civilization as a biological niche or reframing health merely as coherent transition, we are entering perilous territory.
I don't think it's perilous. I think it's necessary.
It risks creating an unoperationalizable theory. If everything is biology, language, institutions, observer emotioning, then the term biology ceases to have rigorous meaning. We lose the precise mechanistic focus required to treat severe pathology.
Okay, I completely understand the fear of losing precision, but the framework isn't saying biology means literally everything.
It kind of sounds like it is.
No, it is saying biology must account for the coordination of everything that makes living possible. Let's actually dig into our first major point of contention here to see how this works in practice, the biological validity of what Saheli calls emotioning.
Let's do it.
So Kaufman's concept of emotional sentience is critical here. We are deeply conditioned in the West to think of emotion as a secondary event.
A psychological event.
Right. You have your true physiological mechanics, like your heart rate, your hormones, and then you have this fleeting feeling that happens to you. But Kaufman shows that emotion is actually an ancient, biological, self-regulatory sense.
Wait, hold on. Stop there. Let's clarify the actual mechanism. How is an emotion distinctly different from a basic physiological feedback loop?
Well, motioning provides the organism with felt valuation. It's a dual logic of self-regulation. Felt valuation.
Yes. Think about it mechanically for a second. Negative feelings like fear or physical pain are fundamentally linked to self-preservation. They trigger withdrawal, avoidance, and the conservation of the physical body.
Sure.
Positive feelings, like trust or curiosity, guide self-development. They prompt the organism to approach, to explore, to bond with others. Therefore, emotioning is not just noise in the machine. As Saheli puts it, emotioning is the valenced organization of possible action.
Valenced organization of possible action. Okay. But what does that actually mean for a patient sitting in an exam room? It means fear literally reorganizes your autonomic tone, your immune readiness, and even your visual perception of the room you are standing in.
I'm not denying the mind-body connection.
When a patient feels profound social shame, their body physically prepares for isolation. You cannot separate the physiological mechanism of a stress hormone from the emotioning of threat. The emotion is the biological organization.
Let me challenge the clinical utility of framing it that way, though. Let's look at the operational reality of medicine. Think of emotioning as the check engine light on a car's dashboard.
Okay.
It is a vital indicator. It tells the driver that something is wrong, and it prompts an action, like pulling over to look under the hood. But if a mechanic treats the check engine light as a core part of the engine's combustion cycle, they lose the ability to fix the actual pistons. The light is a signal. It is not the engine itself.
Yeah, but an organism is not a car. A car does not rebuild its own pistons in real time in response to the light being on. In a living system, the check engine light literally reshapes the engine.
The metaphor has its limits, fair enough. But the practical reality in an emergency room remains exactly the same.
Does it?
Yes. If a patient comes in with severe hypertension, the mechanical reality of their vascular resistance is what is going to cause a stroke. Framing their condition as a valenced organization of possible action does not lower their blood pressure.
I mean, no one is saying you don't treat the blood pressure.
Furthermore, let's look at Saheli's own text. He includes an entire section on methodological safeguards, specifically noting the risk of romanticizing emotion.
Which is a valid safeguard.
And rightly so. Fear can protect, yes, but it can also induce crippling paranoia. Anger can defend a boundary, but it can destroy relationships. Shame can collapse a person's agency entirely.
Mm-hmm.
If these emotions become destructive, how does treating them as core biological mechanisms improve upon targeted physiological or psychiatric interventions? You end up confusing the symptom with the disease mechanism.
See, you're still separating the mind and the body. Treating emotioning as a biological mechanism doesn't mean we just throw pharmacology out the window.
Good, because we need it.
It means we understand how the intervention works within the organism's whole state. If you lower a patient's blood pressure with a beta blocker, but that patient remains in a chronic state of social threat, meaning their environment constantly demands hypervigilance, you are forcing a metric down with a chemical while the organism is screaming to keep it up.
Well, obviously.
You are literally fighting the organism's own survival strategy. That is why Sahali says disease is a discoordination. The organism is trying to preserve itself, but its transition is locked.
Look, I'll grant you the point on the beta blockers. Treating a number on a chart without looking at the patient's stress levels is just bad medicine.
Right.
But you don't need a massive paradigm-shifting five-domain framework to acknowledge that stress affects the heart.
But it's not just stress affects the heart, man. If we accept that a patient's fear physically alters their immune readiness and vascular tone, we can't stop our biological analysis at the edges of their skin.
And here we go.
We have to. What is causing the fear? This forces us to look at the environment they live in, which leads directly to our second major debate point: how this framework scales up to human society.
Right. And this is exactly where the theory expands its borders so wide that I think it completely loses its structural integrity.
Let's explore that then. We have to look at Maturana's concept of the dynamic ecological organism niche unity.
Okay.
Biology traditionally treats the environment as a passive container. You drop an organism into a habitat and it either survives the fixed conditions or it doesn't. But Maturana argues that an organism doesn't just receive a pre-given world, it brings forth a domain of relevance through its own structure and history.
Can you give me a concrete example of bringing forth a domain?
Sure, absolutely. A sound wave. A sound wave is just a physical vibration. It means nothing on its own.
Right.
But an organism's living coordination turns that vibration into a warning, or a mating call, or just background noise. The organism and the niche arise together. Now scale that mechanism up to public health.
Which is a huge leap.
Is it? Housing, air quality, social trust, the language used by our institutions, these are not external sociological variables. They are literal biological boundary conditions. Civilization itself acts as an extended niche.
Mm-hmm.
Sahli argues that a civilization can be salutogenic, meaning it protects the conditions of living, or it can be pathogenic, where it normalizes chronic disruption and then medicalizes the consequences.
And this is exactly what I call civilizational overreach.
Overreach?
Yes. Look, I am a strong proponent of understanding the social determinants of health. No serious medical professional denies that polluted air causes asthma. No one denies that chronic poverty elevates allostatic load.
Let's define allostatic load for a second, just to be precise for everyone. That's when poverty or trauma keeps the body's stress alarms ringing constantly, which literally wears down the physical organs over time. It's the biological cost of chronic adaptation.
Exactly. The physical wear and tear is real. I am not debating that. But equating human institutions, economic systems, and media structures with biological ecology, it dilutes the definition of biology.
I completely disagree.
Let me press you on the actual causality here. When a pathogen strikes, say a novel virus sweeps through a population.
Okay.
Disease-specific mechanisms and chance events remain the primary reality. The virus binds to specific cellular receptors. It replicates using the host's cellular machinery. The primary reality of that disease is viral replication and the host's immune response. It is not civilizational incoherence.
But why did the virus sweep through the population in the first place?
Because of the viral envelope and transmission vectors. If we look at a pandemic and say, ah, this is a discoordination of our civilizational niche, we are doing sociology. We are doing philosophy at that point.
They aren't mutually exclusive.
It might be true on a macro societal level, but it doesn't help us synthesize an mRNA vaccine. It doesn't help us map the spike protein. We have to draw a boundary around what we call biology, the study of living physical organisms, or the discipline loses its operational power to solve immediate problems.
The virus binding to the receptor is multi-level causal realization. It is happening, and mapping it is vital. Nobody is saying we shouldn't study the spike protein.
Well, good.
But Sahali is pointing out that you cannot isolate the viral envelope from the civilizational niche. Perhaps the pathogenic civilizational structures created overcrowded housing, or maybe they destroyed ecological margins, which forced the zoonotic spillover in the first place.
Right, but...
Wait, let me finish. Perhaps the civilizational niche fostered a linguistic environment of such deep institutional distrust that half the population refuses to take the vaccine you synthesized. If you only studied a virus, you will build the vaccine, but the population will still suffer because the niche is fundamentally pathogenic. You need the whole picture.
But the whole picture isn't necessarily biology. I mean, if an asteroid hits the Earth, that affects human health, but astronomy isn't biology.
That's a bit of a straw man.
I don't think it is. But let's bring this down from the theoretical clouds, because if we disagree on whether an economic system can be treated as a biological niche, we really have to examine how this framework actually dictates action when a single organism, a sick patient, is sitting in an exam room.
Yes, absolutely. That is the ultimate test of the theory, clinical intervention. In Sahali's framework, clinical care is not just technical repair of a part, it is structural coupling.
Okay, define structural coupling in a clinical setting.
Think about a doctor walking into a room to give a severe diagnosis. Sahali is arguing that how the doctor speaks, the specific words they use, their physical posture, the quality of their listening, isn't just bedside manner.
Right?
It is a biological intervention. That interaction physically alters the patient's nervous system, changes their heart rate variability, and shifts their immune response in that exact second. Because of this, Sahali champions the concept of Wu Wei.
And this concept deeply, deeply concerns me.
Let me explain it first, though. In Western thought, we often mistranslate Wu Wei as passivity or just doing nothing. But it is not passivity. It is non-forcing participation.
Non-forcing participation.
Right. It means taking action that is precisely proportionate to the living situation. It means using the minimum sufficient force to protect living and open the next coherent transition, deeply respecting the organism's own margins and constraints. Instead of aggressively dominating the disease at all costs, a clinician asks, "What wants to move? What is the organism actively trying to conserve right now?"
And this is where the theory hits a brick wall in the emergency department.
How?
Because, look, I recognize that Sahali tries to mitigate this, but the danger of anti-biomedical misuse is baked right into the concept. Let's use the text's own examples to test this. A patient with sepsis, a patient in diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, or someone with lupus nephritis.
Right.
These are acute, life-threatening crises.
Yes, they are.
If someone is in diabetic ketoacidosis, their blood has literally become acidic because they lack insulin. You don't sit back and ask the blood what it wants to do.
I didn't say you do nothing.
Wu Wei and searching for what wants to move are fundamentally inadequate paradigms here. You have to manually override the chemistry. It is exactly like a pilot taking manual control of a stalling airplane. You push massive intravenous fluids, you push an insulin drip, and you aggressively dictate the physiological systems. You need immunosuppression for lupus nephritis.
I agree with all of that, but Wu Wei does not preclude maximum force.
Then what does it actually mean? If Wu Wei just means do the right, highly aggressive medical intervention when necessary, then it is just a poetic, philosophical word for standard of care. I challenge the idea that Wu Wei is anything more than a luxury applicable only to stable chronic conditions.
It is not just standard of care. Let me give you the perspective directly from the text. Sahali explicitly states that Wu Wei may indeed require urgent surgery or broad-spectrum antibiotics or aggressive resuscitation.
Okay.
The difference is the posture and the depth of intent. Wu Wei means not mistaking the intensity of the intervention for the depth of the healing. You don't keep the airplane in manual override once you're out of the stall.
walk me through the practical difference in treating sepsis then.
Okay, the practical difference is that you do not impose your framework before seeing the whole living process. In sepsis, yes, the minimum sufficient force required to protect living in that moment is massive intravenous antibiotics and vasopressors.
Right.
That is proportionate to the living situation because the threat to the system is massive. But standard biomedicine almost always stops there. It blasts the system, normalizes the lab values on a monitor, and discharges the patient.
Because the immediate threat to life is resolved.
A Wu-Wei approach recognizes that those antibiotics were a massive perturbation to the organism's microbial ecology. It recognizes that the intensive care unit is a profoundly threatening niche that alters the patient's emotioning and autonomic tone long after discharge.
Mm-hmm.
So Wu-Wei dictates that we use the intense force to save the life, but we simultaneously ask, how do we support the organism's next coherent transition? How do we proactively restore the microbiome we just decimated? How do we structurally couple with the patient so they don't develop post-intensive care syndrome? Standard care confuses controlling the acute crisis with actually restoring the living movement of the organism. Wu-Wei demands both.
Look, I will readily grant that post-acute care and modern medicine often fails to look at the whole organism. Patients are discharged into the wind. I agree with that.
Thank you.
But my core concern remains. Terms like minimum sufficient force and non-forcing participation introduce deep ambiguity into a field that relies on algorithmic precision to save lives.
But algorithms have limits.
When a resident physician is treating a crashing patient, I want them following a highly rigid, biologically reductionist algorithm to restore tissue perfusion. I don't want them pausing to evaluate the living movement of the system until the patient is absolutely out of the woods.
What?
The framework requires an immense amount of theoretical discipline to not slide into dangerous vagueness. The fact that Saley had to include 5 separate methodological safeguards just to keep the theory from collapsing on itself proves how fragile it is in a practical setting.
All right, let's pull back and summarize where we stand on this. The biology of living coordination argues that we can no longer afford to separate the mechanism from the meaning.
Right.
A living being conserves its organization while constantly changing its structure in relation to its medium. By integrating Dennis Noble's multi-level causation with Maturana's organism niche unity and Kaufman's emotional sentience, we get a framework that refuses to force life into reductive boxes.
Mm-hmm.
It demands that our scientific distinctions remain answerable to life as it is actually lived. It ensures that when we treat a patient, we are not just fixing a broken machine with a wrench, but participating in the ongoing coordination of a conscious, feeling, relationally embedded living unity. I really believe it is a necessary, rigorous evolution of biology.
And I will concede that biological systems are deeply interconnected, much more so than early genetics led us to believe. Our current mechanistic models often fail to account for the true complexity of human health, especially when it comes to chronic illness and public health disparities.
Exactly.
However, I maintain that elevating observer languaging and emotional sentience to the status of core biological domains creates an overly porous framework. Science advances by drawing boundaries, isolating variables, and defining specific causal pathways.
But at what cost?
The sheer number of safeguards Saheeli had to include, warning against romanticizing emotion, against anti-biomedical misuse, against vague holism, highlights that this framework is constantly at risk of losing its operational precision. It is a beautiful, profound philosophy of care, but a dangerous substitute for mechanistic biology.
Yet, despite our profound disagreements on exactly where to draw the boundaries of this framework, we both clearly agree on Dennis Noble's foundational critique. Genetic sovereignty is a flawed paradigm.
Oh, definitely.
Traditional molecular reductionism, the idea that you can understand a whole human by just looking closer and closer at smaller and smaller parts, has reached its limits. We agree that the organism does not exist in a vacuum, and that the causal arrows point up, down, and across the entire biological system.
Yes, absolutely. There is immense value in questioning our observer-made distinctions. As clinicians and scientists, we have to continually ask ourselves if our models are actually serving the patient in front of us, or if we are just trying to force the patient to fit our neat, predictable models.
Exactly. At the end of the day, we have to return to the map and the territory.
We all want the clarity of the pristine grid. It is comforting to point to a jagged line on an X-ray or a single mutated sequence of DNA and say, there it is. That is the sole cause. I can fix that.
It is comforting.
But living coordination is not a grid. It is a dynamic, feeling, responding reality. We leave it to you, the listener, to explore Dr. Salehi's original white paper and decide for yourself. Where should the boundaries of biological science truly lie? Do we tightly constrain our view to keep the map clean, or do we expand our science to embrace the messy, beautiful complexity of the territory?